From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's sports program, Only a Game. In 1971, the Supreme Court upheld Muhammad Ali's status as a conscientious objector, overruling a lower court that had sentenced the champ to 5 years in jail.
That decision had an enormous impact on Ali's future and the future of the sporting world, the future of America's sense of self.
But that decision would have gone the other way if a law clerk hadn't stood up to his boss. That story is coming up on Only a Game. Plus, songs about sabermetrics? Stay tuned. On April 23, 1971, the Supreme Court voted to send the world's best-known athlete to jail. The count was 5-3, with Justice Thurgood Marshall recusing himself because he'd been with the Justice Department when it went after Muhammad Ali for declining to join the military back in 1967. So why doesn't Ali's biography include several years, up to five, in fact, in a federal prison? Ali, his family, and his millions of fans have a fellow named Tom Krattenmaker, a clerk for Justice John Harlan at the time, to thank.
My initial reaction was that I thought the decision was wrong. So yes, I, just a humble little clerk, sort of said, Mr. Justice, I have an opinion on this. I think it should be coming out the other way, and here's why.
Justice Harlan had been assigned to write the majority opinion, that 5-3 decision that would send Ali to jail. Krattenmaker was the right man in the right place at the right time.
Well, I suppose it's fair to say or accurate to say that I suppose I was one of the people who was most early opposed to the Vietnam War.
In 1966, a little over 5 years before Tom Krattenmaker's life intersected briefly with that of Muhammad Ali, Ali, then known as Cassius Clay, had in part based his claim that he was a conscientious objector on the fact that he was a minister in the Nation of Islam, also known as the Black Muslims, led by Elijah Muhammad. Attorney Jonathan Shapiro, who represented Ali for a time, recalls that it was not a position likely to garner much support.
So there was a great deal of hostility toward those who opposed the war in Vietnam, and there was also a great deal of hostility toward people believed to be domestic terrorists, such as the Nation of Islam, the so-called Black Muslims. So on all of these scores, Muhammad Ali was a lightning rod for all of the people opposed to these movements.
Ali's draft board rejected his application for conscientious objector status. He refused the draft. A federal judge sentenced him to 5 years in prison. Over several years, several lower courts upheld the draft board's decision. Ali's last hope to avoid prison was an appeal to the Supreme Court. But there was one guy in authority who didn't agree with Ali's draft board, the various lower courts, and the Justice Department itself. The guy was Lawrence Grauman, a retired circuit judge in Kentucky. In 1966, shortly after Ali had sought exemption from the draft as a conscientious objector, the Justice Department had asked Judge Grauman to review his claim. Judge Grauman interviewed the champ and concluded that his claim was valid, whereupon the Justice Department, which, remember, had asked for his opinion, presumably to strengthen its case, said essentially, who cares what you think? It didn't seem to matter at the time. Later, it would matter a lot. Shortly after he refused induction, Muhammad Ali had been denied the right to box by various commissions, all of them, actually. But in September of 1970, that right was restored by a U.S. District Court in New York, which bought the argument that since boxing commissions had licensed numerous felons and miscreants throughout the sport's disreputable history, they couldn't bar Ali from the ring because he said he was a conscientious objector. So while he was waiting to hear whether the Supreme Court would hear his appeal, Ali beat Jerry Quarry and Oscar Bonavena. Then he lost his title to Joe Frazier. If the Supreme Court didn't take the case, he'd lose his freedom as well. According to Tom Krattenmaker, the fact that Ali had resumed his career mattered.
That put him back on the sports pages and made it possible for Justice Brennan to make the argument, which he made, that he'd become such an important and large public figure that the public wouldn't understand if the Supreme Court didn't review the case.
So Ali made the judicial big time. 8 of the 9 justices would hear the case that had been heard over and over in lesser courts. And as previously stated, on April 23, 1971, the 8 voted 5-3 to uphold the conviction, and that would have been that, except that Tom Krattenmaker told Justice Harlan that he figured that, as a minister in the Nation of Islam, Ali was entitled to claim he was a conscientious objector.
I thought, perhaps unwisely, but I thought I knew enough about the doctrines that Elijah Muhammad had propounded in the Lost Foundation of Islam. What those doctrines stood for was a pacifism that had only one exception, and that was for wars that were declared by God, as he would put it, declared by Allah, to fight a theocratic war. And for all other wars, it was people who belonged to what they called the Lost Foundation of Islam were not to participate.
Muhammad Ali had presented the same argument, but he'd also said things like, "I got no quarrel with them Viet Cong," which had perhaps bolstered the argument that Ali only opposed certain specific wars, such as the one the U.S. was waging in Southeast Asia, rather than all wars. Krattenmaker focused on the fact that Ali's faith dictated that he could only fight in a war declared by Allah. Practically, this meant no wars declared by men. Just over 15 years earlier, a member of the Jehovah's Witnesses had prevailed at the Supreme Court with a similar argument. Okay, but how often does a decision get changed after the Supreme Court has voted?
I'd say it happens maybe 2 times a term, maybe 3 times a year, when a justice who was assigned to write an opinion or one of the other justices changes his or her mind, and it therefore changes the outcome in the case. It's not always a result of some law clerk arguing a point. It can be delving into the record, or you're trying to write the opinion and you realize how complicated it is. But it's what should I say? Maybe it happens once in 100 cases.
It happened in 1971, in part certainly because Tom Krattenmaker, who'd been opposed to the war for years, helped it to happen, and in part because between 1966 and 1971, a lot of the rest of the country had embraced the attitudes Krattenmaker had developed as a college student. Anyway, it happened. But then what? Because even after Tom Krattenmaker had changed Justice Harlan's mind, the score stood 4-4. In baseball, a tie goes to the runner. At the Supreme Court, a tie affirms the lower court's decision. 4-4, like 5-3, meant Ali would go to jail. But the court had agreed to hear Ali's case because they wanted to demonstrate that the system was fair, even to a member of the Nation of Islam. Again, Jonathan Shapiro.
Sending somebody to jail with a 4-4 split and the Supreme Court not being able to make up its mind conveyed the completely opposite conclusion.
So 4-4 couldn't stand. But how would the 4 justices who wanted to overturn Ali's conviction convince the 4 inclined to uphold it to switch their votes? Here's where that retired judge in Kentucky comes in, the guy who was asked by the Justice Department to interview Ali and assure the department that he was not sincere in his religious beliefs. When the retired judge opined otherwise, the Justice Department neglected to mention his opinion to the draft board.
Justice Stewart argued that when the Justice Department had given advice to the local draft board, they had told the draft board that Ali was not sincere in his religious beliefs. Then, when the case finally got to the Supreme Court, almost 5 years later, the United States government, through the Solicitor General, told the court, "We do not doubt or deny his sincerity."
As Tom Krattenmaker recalls, Justice Stewart spied a way to break the tie.
The Justice Department had given erroneous legal advice to the draft board, and since the draft board never explained why they're denying MCO status, they just said we're denying it, it could be that they were relying on that advice, which they now themselves admit was erroneous.
That logic, or sleight of hand, however you want to characterize it, provided the out the justices needed. The record would show that Muhammad Ali's conviction had been overturned by a vote of 8-0. Nearly half a century after Muhammad Ali's 5-year ordeal was ended by that decision, Tom Krattenmaker recalls that he felt good about it. Not giddy, necessarily, which is how I might have felt in his place, but good. Krattenmaker says he was just doing his job. Jonathan Shapiro, one of the attorneys representing Ali at the time, feels that by doing his job, Krattenmaker helped change contemporary history.
That decision had an enormous impact on Ali's future, and to that extent, the future of the sporting world, the future of America's sense of self. But for that, he would have spent 5 years in a federal prison, and that would have been the end, I think, of his role in America's conscience.
I came across the story of Tom Krattenmaker and Muhammad Ali's case in Lee Montville's most recent book, Sting Like a Bee, subtitled Muhammad Ali versus the United States of America, 1966 to 1971. And it's terrific. In weeks like these, heck, in months like these, it's sometimes hard to remember why sports are important. But as commentator Alyssa Eli recalls, sometimes they are.
For many years, my stepfather was an afterthought in my adolescent life. The man from Flatbush, Brooklyn, who took everyone to dinner, watered my mother's garden before his tennis doubles, loved the Yankees, and pondered serious questions that caused great embarrassment. "What's the meaning of life, baby?" he would ask, pointing the hose at a geranium. I had no desire to illuminate him. I had no desire to talk about the Yankees either. Yet somehow, through his endurance and my own blessed aging, my stepfather endeared himself to me. In decades that followed, he took new generations to dinner and asked his grandchildren about the meaning of life. He watched his Yankees lose year after year. And then, one spring, he was suddenly too tired to play tennis. By fall, options for treating his cancer had been exhausted. Hospice was enlisted, and he lay at home in bed thinly, greeting visitors. All these years, he'd been thinking about the meaning of existence. Suddenly, I wanted to know what his thoughts were. I imagined our conversation. It would be about the higher purposes of life, and of course, about death. It would be deep and important. 2 weeks before my stepfather died, I drove down with my husband. It was October 1996. In the bedroom with chintz valances, Martin was watching TV and dozing. Yankees versus Braves in the World Series. "Hello, baby," he said, and squeezed my hand. My husband hovered in the background. He was very fond of his father-in-law, but not one for deep emotional diving. I was pondering how to begin the conversation. Then my stepfather noticed my husband and beckoned him over. He nodded towards the screen. "I saw Don Larsen pitch his perfect game in 56, he said. "I was in the stands." My husband shook his head, admiring the past. "That was something," my stepfather said with pleasure. He nodded towards a chair. I stood up. My husband sat down. For a long time, they talked together, the two of them, about baseball and perfect games. It was deep. It was important. It was life.
Alyssa Eli is a community psychiatrist in Massachusetts. You're listening to Only a Game from NPR. I'd like to thank Laz0320 for leaving the following review of Only a Game on iTunes. "I've been an evangelizing fan since I first woke up to this broadcast at an unspeakable hour on a Saturday morning years ago. Thanks to the interwebs and podcasting, I've been able to sleep in, move to a new time zone, and still witness for this show. Listen to this. You won't regret it. Amen." Have you subscribed to the Only a Game podcast yet? It's the best way to make sure you never miss an episode. And while you're there, consider leaving us a review. It really does help other listeners to find our show. I'm Bill Littlefield, and it's time for three stories you should know. That's the sound of Holly Kneeher becoming, as far as we know, the first girl in the history of Florida high school football to throw a touchdown pass. Girls and tackle football. That's where we're going to begin this week. I'm joined by Mike Pesca. He's the host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist, and The Wall Street Journal's Rachel Bachman. Welcome back to both of you.
Great to be here, Bill.
Thanks for having me.
Rachel, you're first.
Yes, well, it might be surprising to many of us who followed the decline in participation of youth football, but participation among girls is on the rise, as you heard in the clip. About twice as many girls as 10 years ago are on boys' high school football teams. Hmm. And that's not all. There are new girls-only tackle leagues in a couple of states that are growing. Interest in tackle football among girls is at an all-time high. And of course, this raises some controversy. Some people say, why are they following the boys into what we're realizing is perhaps an even more dangerous sport than we thought? The flip side of that is they play with different rules. They eliminated punts and kickoffs to try to cut down on collisions. And they place a great emphasis on proper tackling technique. The girls I talked to said they're just following their lifelong love. They grew up watching football, maybe playing touch football with their brothers. I talked to a few girls who said they switched from cheerleading to football and they like football better.
Mike, can you get behind this?
Oh, definitely. I think if football were, first of all, every culture has tackling sports, and there's so much to recommend football. We've clearly been doing it at least a bit wrong for these last 100 years. So if you have a chance to invent it anew and keep the best parts about it, that's, I think, a great opportunity. And a girls-only league is so much safer than them playing with the, physically heavier and more athletic boys. I think I see, especially if it's monitored correctly in terms of the brain, almost no downside to this.
One time somebody asked me how I felt about women boxing, and I said, I don't like it. And they said, well, you were a sexist. And I said, no, I don't like men boxing either. So I feel a little bit the same way. And all I can say is if women and girls start playing football in great numbers, I sure hope they're going to fare better than their male counterparts in terms of how honestly they're treated by their coaches, their trainers, their league executives, the doctors employed by the teams, etc.
Well, you know, Bill, the trend when women participate in a sport, and remember years ago there was the women's version of basketball where not everyone could cross half court, but the trend has been to protect the women, to perhaps cosset the women, and there's been an overprotection. So maybe that instinct to be extra protective because there are girls playing will pay off in this one instance where the health of the players will finally be prioritized.
Well, let me see if I understand what you're saying, because this is potentially fascinating, that if the women's game, as Rachel has described it, catches on, maybe the men's game will be modified to become actually a safer game for everybody playing it?
I wasn't actually thinking that. But now that you mention it, you know, let's say that there is enough sample size in 10 years to compare women concussion rates to men concussion rates in the very same sport of football. I think that would be really compelling evidence to perhaps reform and to look at the differences in how the game is played.
Actually, Bill, in Mooresville, Indiana, where one of these girls' leagues exists, the president of the league, who also oversees the boys' leagues, said that they have talked about using the girls' rules in the boys' games. And so that'll be interesting going forward, whether they do adapt these rules for the younger boys' teams.
That is the most positive and promising reason I've heard for more women and girls playing football. Mike, I'm going to turn to you now. You're up.
Oh, yes. So perhaps you heard between our fair towns, Bill, and me here in New York, there was a little kerfuffle involving an Apple Watch, Red Sox stealing signs. And Jeff Passan, in his write-up about actually the history of sign stealing in baseball, made a reference to an old Society of American Baseball Researchers article written by Joe Dittmar called A Shocking Discovery. I loved learning about this. The year was 1900, and it was the Phillies. A guy by the name of Pierce N. Petey Childs, who is also known as What's the Use? Is that a nickname or what?
Perfect.
Petey Childs would stand in the third base coach's box, weirdly, in the middle of a wet spot all the time, and do this weird dance. And at home, Philadelphia hitters did well. They ripped the cover off the ball. Turns out he was getting signals from a backup catcher who was stealing signs. and then relaying them to him via electronic device. And this was sussed out by Tommy Corcoran, the Reds shortstop and captain, who one day, I'll read from the article, acting like a giant demonic chicken searching for grain, Tommy raised the ire of the Philadelphia groundskeeper as he began scratching with his spikes the third base coaching area. The groundskeeper, even some Philadelphia police, the umpire, began digging up the third base area. And they found a small wooden box, and they opened up and found an electric buzzer device. Childs was caught, but the umpire at the time evoked Admiral Dewey, who had just won the Battle of Manila Bay, saying, "Come on, Dewey went into Manila Bay, never giving a tinker's damn for all the mines concealed therein. Come on, play ball." Other teams in the league took umbrage. But another interesting aspect of this is it seems that Pittsburgh was also involved in a sign-stealing scheme of their own, and they in Philadelphia agreed not to cheat while playing each other.
So, Rachel, what is this latest episode? Just one more instance in a long and grand tradition of sign-stealing, sometimes via electronics, sometimes not?
Well, I have a theory about this. Of course, the signs were apparently transmitted via Apple Watch. And I don't know if you know, but Apple is pushing the health and sports uses for Apple Watch hard. So what better way to get out the word that Apple Watch is for athletes and people who are physical than to embed it in this controversial story involving one of the most storied franchises in sports? So certainly everyone's talking about the Apple Watch now. Mission accomplished.
Well, far be it for me to get in the way of product placement.
Well, I know Fitbit shares recently spiked based on the fact that they're doing some glucose monitoring. If they get into the sign-stealing business, I'm investing.
All right, it's my turn. The women's semifinal round of the U.S. Open included nothing but U.S. players. First time that's happened since 1981. And one of the semifinalists, Madison Keys, marked the occasion by saying, "I can't tell you how many times I've had to hear, you know, how horrible tennis is in America. I know Serena Williams has more important things to do these days. I hope she wasn't listening to Madison Keys. How can anybody make the argument that tennis is horrible in the U.S.? I mean, men's tennis, maybe, but women, come on. The best tennis-playing woman who ever lived is in the U.S. She happens to be having a little bit of time off to bring up a child right now. But come on, that was ridiculous. Mike, help me out.
And the second best tennis-playing woman who ever lived, Martina Navratilova, became a U.S. citizen. That was her choice.
Exactly.
Third's probably someone like Billie Jean King. Yes, that's the thing. Whenever we talk about a sport on the decline, we call it a sport on the decline, but it usually means the men's version of the sport is on the decline for years and years and years. Soccer, will soccer break through? Have you looked at women's soccer participation, dominance, everything else? The U.S. women are so often, because of Title IX and because of, especially compared to other societies, we encourage our girls to play sports, are so often so dominant, and that just gets swept aside as if that part of the word sport doesn't exist.
All right, Rachel, I think we need you to stand up for the possibility that tennis in America is horrible.
Absolutely not. I will not take that perspective. Not only is Serena arguably the top player of all time, or maybe inarguably, but her sister is in the top 10 in titles, and they're treated like furniture so often. It's like, well, except for the Williams sisters, this is the first time that an American woman, I mean, as though you just sort of like set them aside for the past, you know, 15 plus years. I think we've just become so accustomed to their greatness, we just take it for granted. And it's just astounding when this narrative unfolds. Oh my goodness, there's American women in the semis. It's like, like every single year, you know, but we should pause and appreciate their greatness because they're not going to be around much longer.
All right. Well, I appreciate the fact that we've been unanimous on this point, and I apologize to Madison Keys if she feels like we've been ganging up on her. That was certainly not my intention. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Mike Pesca. He's the host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist, and The Wall Street Journal's Rachel Bachman. Thanks to both of you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Bill.
When you think of sports in the state of Ohio, you probably think of college football.
Urban Meyer and the number 2-ranked Ohio State Buckeyes on a mission.
But there's another sport, well, sort of sport, that has a proud tradition in the Buckeye State, and you can't find it anywhere else. Only a game's Martin Kessler has this story.
The prompt was, "It wasn't easy to get rid of. Describe how." Do you want me to read the whole thing?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. As we drove to the animal hospital, my eyes started to fill with tears. I prayed that he was okay, but deep down, I think I knew that this was just a distraction. I knew.
This is Maddie. She's a recent graduate of Gahanna Middle School East, and her coach, Jessica Anderson. The sport is creative writing, competitive creative writing. It's called Power of the Pen, and it works like this. Competitors are given a prompt and 40 minutes to write a short story by pen. In case you didn't already know, Gahanna Middle School East boasts one of the state's elite Power of the Pen programs. To get to Coach Anderson's office, well, classroom, you pass by the school's large trophy case. Next to the wrestling and basketball awards, there's an entire section for trophies adorned with golden quills and pens. During the 2015-16 Power of the Pen season, Coach Anderson gave me inside access. Thanks to regular Skype calls, she kept me updated on our team, especially two of her star writers, Maddie, who you heard from earlier, and Jenna. They're pretty tight.
Yeah, they sit at the same lunch table and things like that, yeah.
I'm gonna assume you can still appreciate the magnitude of that. Anyways, you know how some elite athletes are born playing their sports? They skate before they can walk, things like that. Well, here's Jenna.
I didn't really know what Power of the Pen was, and I wasn't sure if I really wanted to do it. But my parents kind of made me, so, yeah.
Okay, but Jenna and Maddie both made the team as seventh graders. And in her rookie season, Jenna made it all the way to the state finals. Maddie did not. But instead of being jealous or bitter, Maddie volunteered to help out at states. She wanted to be there with her friend.
I took papers to the judges from different writing rooms. It was really fun.
Adorable, right? Mrs. Anderson thinks it was inspiring, too.
I think for Maddie, it was a, wow, this is really fun and I want to be a competitor, not just a helper.
So the following September, Maddie and Jenna returned to Coach Anderson's team for their eighth grade years. Preseason expectations were high. Practices started at 7 a.m. Mrs. Anderson put her team through drills, well, practice prompts such as your main character is an alien, and had team meetings to talk through potential plots.
And then it's like the alien literally thinks she's on Venus, and then the girl told her she's not on Venus.
That's some good stuff.
Okay, now for me.
After Thanksgiving break, still a few weeks before the team's first competition, I asked Jenna what it was like being one of her school's star writers. What's it like to be on the team? Do people think it's cool?
Well,
you can be honest.
Not exactly. Like, some people kind of judge, but I don't really care what people think about me, so I just like to write, so, yeah.
That's true.
But a few minutes later, after Jenna left the room, I spoke with Mrs. Anderson privately.
Maddie's doing fine. Jenna, I'm a little worried about. I feel like some days she's not taking it as seriously, and it could be because of the peer pressure she was talking about. Like, I'm glad she fully admitted it. And I don't know, like, I'm still missing a prompt from her. Right now, she wouldn't even qualify to go on to districts.
But Jenna and Maddie did qualify for districts, and they advanced to regionals, where they'd have a shot at earning a berth to states. On the morning of the competition, Mrs. Anderson sent me an email. The team seems very relaxed, so I'm unsure what's to come. ESPN hasn't bought the Power of the Pen broadcast rights yet, so back in Boston, I had to wait for the news to trickle in. It actually took weeks for Mrs. Anderson to call with the final results. She had just gotten back from spring break, and
we call it the white envelope, was there waiting for me, and that's basically from the state office of Power of the Pen. And it basically has, you know, the final results from regionals and who qualified to move on to states. I was, like, completely devastated because none of my eighth graders qualified.
The judges who scored the stories had ranked Maddie 30th. A good showing, but on the wrong side of the Power of the Pen bubble. Mrs. Anderson took Maddie and Jenna aside to deliver the bad news.
They were okay. I think they were really disappointed. And, like, I just need to kind of sit down with them again and, you know, give them their certificates and say, you know what, I'm really proud of you. Don't ever give up on creative writing because you guys have a talent. And in the past 2 years, it's shown.
When I spoke to Maddie and Jenna on their very last days of eighth grade, Jenna had some good news for me.
There's, like, a writing club at high school, so I was going to try that.
I know, a boring writing club, not a writing team. Even so, Maddie says she was thinking about checking it out too. And I was glad to hear it. because creative writing does have something in common with golf and basketball and soccer. The more you practice, the better you get at it.
That's Only a Game's Martin Kessler. Since we reported this story, Mrs. Anderson has retired from coaching Power of the Pen. She's now a librarian, and maybe someday she'll be shelving a book written by one of her former players. That'd be cool.
Somebody put something in my Gatorade.
Mike Patton writes songs about baseball.
You can take a bullpen catcher, you can take a pinch runner, you can take a lefty reliever. It's endless. I mean, this game goes back to 1876, and we see new things every day.
That's just ahead on Only a Game, and you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
Hi, I'm Erica Lance, and I think you might like this podcast I produce, also from WBUR, called Kind World. Kind World tells deeply personal stories about the pivotal moments in our lives.
She called me one day and she says, "Why are you choosing to live in our grief?" And I said, "I'm not. I'm choosing to live in your love."
All of those women were witness to the darkest and probably most intimate moment of my life, and they gave me a sliver of light.
I talk to all kinds of people about times when they felt alone or scared or overwhelmed and how they got through it with the help of others.
I even thought I was a little crazy, but then I'm like, wait, I could do anything I want. I could raise $1 million if I want to. I could cure this disease.
I think that he bypassed all that and just said, I see a human being who needs my help and I'm going to help him.
Head over to WBUR.org/kindworld. Or just subscribe in your favorite podcast app.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, stories about the first player to register a hit in professional baseball from the last living relative who actually met him. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
The NFL season is underway, and Vegas has spoken, and they have made the New York Jets 1,000-1 to win the Super Bowl. Are those odds long enough, or are you going to wait for 2,000-1?
Oh, I'm hanging in there. However, as we learned on Thursday night, the Jets have a chance to be one game ahead of the defending Super Bowl champions on Sunday.
Yeah, there was another little bit that I read that suggested there were five candidates to dethrone the New England Patriots, current Super Bowl champs. Raiders, Steelers, Packers, Seahawks, and Falcons were the five teams listed. Interestingly enough, Kansas City, not among them.
Well, let's be fair. I mean, Kansas City didn't dethrone the Patriots. They just beat them very badly on opening night. I mean, it was pretty embarrassing. The Patriots had this incredible extravaganza before the game. They hung the banner. Everybody cheered. Everybody booed Roger Goodell. A lot of people showed up with red clown noses on their face as a statement of protest against Roger Goodell. And then the football team went out on the field and stunk up the joint.
Seattle Seahawks defensive end Michael Bennett said this week that shortly after last month's Mayweather-McGregor spectacle, police officers in Las Vegas stopped him, handcuffed him, and threatened him with a gun. Bennett says, quote, "for being a black man in the wrong place at the wrong time." Any reason to think he's got that wrong?
No, near as I can tell from the photographs and all, no. Sooner or later, Bill, we're going to lose an athlete. We're going to lose a high-profile athlete to a trigger-happy law enforcement guy. And I don't know that that'll change anything, but it will happen sooner or later.
I'm going to surprise you now because I'm going to suggest that we talk at least briefly about a couple of college football games played last weekend. Liberty University against Baylor and UCLA against Texas A&M. The outcomes would seem to have something in common, no?
Well, one thing, Liberty over Baylor is one of the most amazing upsets ever. And UCLA had to come all the way back from 34 points down to beat Texas A&M. Quarterback Josh Rosen got a leg up on the Heisman field.
Got it. Nice pose.
Thank you. And you won't see, you know, a more amazing individual performance than that all year. I don't care that it's only the second or third week of the season.
Stacey Lewis had not won a tournament on the LPGA Tour in 3 years. And a lot of people in Houston are very happy that she broke that losing streak on Sunday, Charlie.
Yeah, she won the tournament in Portland, Oregon. And she sent her $195,000 first-place check to Harvey Relief in Houston. And I think that's really quite something.
Yeah, she's a Houston native,
she's from Houston,
of course.
Yes.
Right. The 2017 class of the Basketball Hall of Fame will be inducted this weekend. It will include Rebecca Lobo, Tracy McGrady, and George McGinnis, among others. Any of the other names stand out for you?
Well, the one that stands out to me is Rebecca Lobo, because I thought for sure she was already in the Hall
of
Fame.
I would have thought so, too. Yes, absolutely.
And you know, I think McGinnis is a good grab. He's you know, there aren't many of the guys from the old ABA who you would consider for the Hall of Fame. He was one of the last ones. And I'm very happy for George McGinnis.
The LA Clippers have reconfigured their arena to provide what they are calling star courtside seats. For $175,000, you can see each Clippers home game from one of these seats. You want to sign on right here?
No, I don't, because I hate sitting right at courtside. I like an elevated view of the game. I always have. All you see at courtside in the NBA is a lot of really big people going really
legs.
Fast. Going really fast.
Yeah. I hope they can find enough stars in Los Angeles for those star courtside
seats.
Well,
I mean, there's at least, probably 5 or 6 TV shows that get canceled before the NBA season starts. So those folks will have
nothing else to do. That's right. The WNBA playoffs are ongoing. The Seattle Storm out of the postseason. But late last week, star guard Sue Bird became the league's all-time assists leader.
Yeah.
She has 2,600 assists. That's a lot of assists.
You know what it means? A lot of people are hitting shots, too.
Yeah.
I mean, let's be fair. This isn't like hockey.
Yeah, but she throws them to the right people.
She does throw them to the right people in the right places at the right time, yes.
Finally, Charlie, I know how much you love world records.
All right. Sports!
I don't know how much you like guacamole. However, in Mexico, they like it a lot, or at least they like to make a lot of it. And are you ready for a world record pot of 6,600 pounds of guacamole?
3 tons of guacamole and a tortilla chip.
A giant tortilla chip
the size of Saskatchewan.
All right, there's another world record.
Sports!
And it goes with guacamole. It's about beer. In Bavaria, Oliver Strumpfell recently broke his own beer stein carrying record by transporting 31 of the full steins. And they weighed 152 pounds altogether, and he carried them over 130 feet, and he not only didn't fall, as in Strumpfell, he didn't sneeze, I guess.
Yeah, but he dropped a couple of them, so the record is 29.
Oh.
This is a real tragedy.
I wonder if they booed when he dropped two.
This is the brand new agony of defeat thing for Wide World of Sports. Oliver had 31 tankards, walked 40 meters with them, and put them down. But as he was putting them down, 2 fell over, which apparently in tankard carrying, you know, qualifies as not having been carried if it doesn't stand up on the table. I feel bad for Oliver. I really do. It's 152 pounds of beer, or as we used to call it when I was in college, Thursday afternoon.
I was afraid you were heading in that direction. You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time, and he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Baseball statistics used to be easy. Some of you may remember those days. A great pitcher, he was the guy who won about twice as many games as he lost. A good hitter, he was the guy with a batting average over 300. Fans eager for complication could discuss the pitcher's earned run average or the hitter's runs batted in. During the conversation, somebody was bound to mention the scout who could tell a great player by watching him get off the bus. No statistics need apply. Then in 1980, along came Bill James with something he called sabermetrics, a word that combined the acronym for the Society for American Baseball Research with the scary concept of metrics. Scary at least for a fellow like me who'd stalled out at Algebra 2. Over the past 3-plus decades, sabermetrics devotees have developed ever more complicated ways to, as Bill James himself put it, search for objective knowledge about baseball. Major League Baseball eventually embraced the quest. In 2003, Moneyball, written by Michael Lewis, made a hero of Oakland Athletics general manager Billy Beane for doing that. Fans of James and Moneyball could almost forget that Oakland never could win when it counted most. But that didn't discourage those dedicated to the ever-expanding search for the perfect way to quantify baseball's mysteries. And maybe that's a good thing, because if the quest hadn't continued, maybe there'd be no reason for this next story from Only a Game's Gary Wallach.
Mike Patton is a Nashville school teacher. He's loved baseball since he was a 7-year-old living in New Orleans. His dad loved it, too. But New Orleans has never had a major league team. Back in the early 80s, there was pretty much only one way for Mike and his dad to enjoy major league ball.
I'd go get the Times-Picayune and bring it back, and we'd look at the sports section together and look at the baseball box scores and stuff, and I'd try to figure out what they all meant, and he'd explain it to me, you know, as best he could.
Mike and his dad made occasional road trips to see the Astros and a handful of other MLB teams. But most of the time, Mike just dug into the daily box scores to learn about the major leaguers he admired.
To find at least one stat, whether it's Vince Coleman, look at all these stolen bases. Look at Ricky Henderson. He can hit home runs and steal bases. If Mark McGwire was this new guy that we heard about and he hit 49 home runs, suddenly that was a name. The guys with the good stats, that's who we wanted to talk about.
Mike's young life revolved around ERA, RBI, and batting average. But by 1999, when he returned to New Orleans after 4 years of college, the world of baseball stats had dramatically changed. Sabermetrics had come to overshadow the more traditional categories. The new stats were notorious for their complexity and often their divisiveness. Mike did his best to learn sabermetrics, but...
You know, I don't know. It kind of takes the fun out of discussing baseball and stats in general.
But Mike kept discussing them anyway, first as a blogger and then as the writer of over 800 Yahoo Sports columns. Mike found it just wasn't possible to avoid sabermetrics, like WAR.
WAR is, officially, it's wins above replacement, and... What it does is it projects a value for each major league ball player that is supposed to give you the number of wins that each player is worth above a replacement level player.
Oh, I get it. Actually, no, I don't.
No one can even give you like a solid answer, but basically what they want to come up with is they basically calculate how many runs that player is worth. And then from what I understand, it basically takes like 10 runs to equal one win to go to that player's WAR. So like if a player like Chris Bryant...
Did I mention that Mike is a part-time musician? While he was wrestling with sabermetrics and their usefulness, Mike began writing songs about baseball. He started a band with his brother Todd and called it Vista Blue after one of his Little League teams in New Orleans. Mike borrowed melodic inspiration from the Ramones and Weezer, and the baseball themes began to emerge.
I was listening to classic rock, and the song War, What Is It Good For? Came on this classic rock channel here in Nashville. It just hit me. I was like, yeah, you know, this is the time to just do it. I remember back when we were kids. There was on the stat for everything that we did. We only cared about the final score. And I don't even know what they're saying anymore. I know OBP. I know SLG. But tell me WAR. What is it good for? It was a joke. I just wrote the song by putting together some stats that I knew versus WAR, which I didn't. But tell me WAR.
Despite his tuneful skepticism, Mike Patton says he does belong to a sabermetrics group on Facebook, where some WAR devotees aggressively push their agenda. Some even attempt to discredit Major League MVP and Cy Young Award winners by demonstrating how their WAR numbers prove that those who voted for them were wrong. Mike posted WAR, What Is It Good For? On Facebook, thinking it might set the rigid sabermetricians straight. But
a couple guys just kind of chuckled at it. What's it good for now? You know what I mean? Like, I think that they thought it was like, I was writing from the perspective of some poor fool who didn't worship the statistic, I guess.
The chuckles didn't bother Mike.
All I can tell you is that I have not heard anyone tell me I'm wrong.
He's probably not heard anyone tell him he's not prolific either.
I do like to take classic song titles and use them as like baseball song titles. So like we have a song called Give Reese a Chance, you know, instead of Give Peace a Chance, where, you know, this poor guy Reese just sits on the bench and the coach won't play him. He always hustles, he runs into walls. He risks his life just to chase down by balls. His clothes are clean, there's no dirt on his pants. And all we're saying is give Reese a chance. We got a song called My Best Friend's Glove, you know, about making a play with a glove that you borrow from your best friend. I'm in the play with my best friend's glove. Oh, yeah. And I don't think I'll be giving
Mike Patton is married with three kids. His youngest, an 8-year-old daughter, watches Cubs games with him. There's no MLB team in Nashville, so he must feel he's come full circle in some ways. He's now written over 30 songs about baseball and says he plans to keep writing them because the sport constantly presents interesting subjects.
You take a bullpen catcher, you can take a pinch runner, you can take a lefty reliever, it's endless. And when you start going from not only the major leagues, but down to AAA, down to rookie league, to college, to little league, I mean, this game goes back to 1876, and we see new things every day.
Somebody put something in my Gatorade. This is the worst game that I've ever played.
Sounds like Mike Patton is ready for anything. Even the next wave of arcane stats conjured up by baseball's dweebiest eggheads. That leads me to wonder aloud if he has ever dreamed of becoming the official statistical songwriter of Major League Baseball.
No, but if they called me and wanted that, I think I could do it.
That's Only a Game's Gary Wallach talking with Mike Patton of Vista Blue. In time for the 2018 Winter Olympics, the band will release a 7-inch split single featuring songs about curling. The other band on that single will be our old friends, the Zambonis. The best hitter I've ever seen in person over a significant length of time was Wade Boggs. Statistics? You could look it up. If you do, you'll find that during one stretch of consecutive seasons, he hit 341, 361, 325, 368, 357, 363, and 366. He won 5 batting titles and led the American League in on-base percentage 6 times. Once I had the opportunity to ask some of his teammates if they could learn anything from watching him, and they all said no, because he was Wade Boggs, and they weren't. One knock on Boggs when he was playing in Boston was that he didn't hit when it counted, and that was silly. In order to place his more than 200 hits per season where they wouldn't count, he'd have had to have been a very precise and careful failure. Another knock on Boggs was that he could calculate his batting average as he ran to first base and was inclined to do so. The suggestion was that he cared only about his own statistics. So what, says I, better a proud lout who hits 360 than a selfless everything-for-the-team guy who hits 249. Maybe it's because Boggs hit so well and so often that I remember seeing him strike out one evening. I think there were men on base when he did it, and a disappointed kid behind me started to boo, and then he shouted, "Boggs, you stink!" I know now I shouldn't have said anything. I knew it then. No matter. I twisted in my cramped seat and said, "He's the best hitter you've ever seen." And then I quickly returned my attention to the field so I wouldn't see that kid give me the finger. I don't know what his war number was or would have been, but Wade Boggs liked to play war. When the Red Sox were on the road, he would sometimes creep around the corridors of the team hotel claiming he was Delta Force. He'd burst through doors to surprise teammates in embarrassing circumstances. Ho, ho, what a fun teammate. He did some other peculiar things. During spring training in 1991, he fell out of his Jeep, and then his wife, who was driving, ran over him. By mistake, they said. Boggs somehow escaped injury, as he did on another occasion when he was allegedly accosted outside a nightclub by a knife-wielding mugger. Wade Boggs claimed he'd foiled the attack by willing himself invisible. That made him 2-for-2, an emerging whole from episodes where survival intact must have seemed unlikely. But then Wade Boggs was a survivalist. He told me that during an interview toward the end of his career when I asked him how he had maintained his extraordinary concentration in the face of multiple loud distractions. Survivalists arm themselves and hunker down in Montana behind mounds of canned food waiting for the apocalypse, so I think Boggs meant survivor. But maybe not. I don't know what sort of metrics could be developed to measure the likes of Wade Boggs. I'm pretty sure Bill James and his adherents don't know either, which is just one reason I don't think the game and the people who play it will ever be reduced entirely to numbers. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal, and our senior producer is Karen Given. Our final word comes from songwriter Mike Patton, who explains why he wrote a song about those batters who knock over the jug of Gatorade after striking out.
To us, it's like, what about all the other guys who wanted to drink Gatorade that day?
First, the Apple Watch. Now Gatorade. We may have set an only-a-game record this week for product placement. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports, NPR style, and Only a Game, and thanks for listening.